Boom, we're on.
We're on.
Guests, we can cut the sprint times. How are you, brother?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Yeah.
Thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure. It's been a long time in the making.
Yeah, definitely. Great story, mate. Premiership footballer, turned boxing, turned manager. You've had a up and down life, basically, in prisons, charges everywhere, but also a phenomenal career from a young kid, 17. I think you're the youngest ever to captain. Was it Sheffield United?
I was, yeah. Still a record that stands today.
Yeah, played for England under 21s, £1 million signing on fees. It's a bit of a career, man. Like, yeah. Retiring early, it's all over the place.
Definitely, yeah. All over the place is probably the right word. And, you know, I am one of them. I even now, I'm 41 now, and I think to myself sometimes, God, I wonder what I'm going to do when I get older. I've kind of got that personality. I'm always drifting from thing to thing. But sometimes it's hard sometimes having so much success at such a young age when you don't really know how to deal with it. And that's what happened with me in football. If I'd had my time again, I'd probably retired a lot earlier. I retired at 26, but I was probably done by the time I was 22. I didn't really know what else to do. The only other thing that I was all right at was fighting. So I thought, instead of getting locked up all the time for it, I might as well try and make a few quid. So I went into boxing, then quickly realised I'm not actually very good at fighting. So, yeah.
You said you had over 100 fights on the streets before you went and turned pro, which is pretty mad considering the reputation you had on the football field. And people look at footballers and think they've kind of got to stay level-headed, but you were in papers and doing your thing.
And I think, listen, a lot of them were self-preservation, you know, my fights. And say I had 100 fights, you know, makes me sound really hard, but I probably lost 95 of them. You know what I mean? I'm 5'6" now. So as a kid, I was always real small. And that's where I'm from, a little market town in Driffield. It's not very multicultural at all. Our next door neighbour had a black Labrador called Nigger. So that's the environment I was brought up in. So I was fighting all the time, like I said, for self-preservation more than anything. You know, I used to run home crying all the time. And my dad used to say to me, listen, if you don't do anything about it, you're going to be running back here crying until you're a grown man, you know, get out there and defend yourself type of thing. So the first time I actually hit somebody back, it felt good. It felt quite liberating. And what I realized at a young age is people don't actually like fighting. People don't like confrontation. So if you don't even need to be able to fight, just look like you can fight. You know, I always say to the kids that come to my boxing classes, if someone starts a fight and you get in your boxing stance and say to them, come on then. And that person thinks, oh shit, this kid knows what he's doing a little bit. And 95, 97% of people think, I'll leave that one alone. Because people don't like the confrontation of it. So as soon as I started trying to defend myself and fighting back, people had stopped calling me the names. So I kind of took that into later life. You know, if anyone wanted to argue or have a fight with me, I was always willing to participate. At this time, I'm a professional footballer. So whenever you're getting into trouble, it ends up in the newspapers. And you know, I love the saying that the youth is wasted on the young. And that's definitely the situation with me. I made so many stupid mistakes as a young boy that I wouldn't, as a 17-year-old kid, I wouldn't do as a 41-year-old man. But we all do that, don't we?
Yeah, but we all make mistakes, brother. We're all young at once. And some just make more mistakes than others. Some don't learn, some do learn. I always go back to the start of my guest, Curtis, where you grew up and how it all began.
Yeah, well, I'm from a market town, like I say, about half an hour from here called Driffield. So my dad was born in 1956. So if you actually look at my dad's birth certificate, his name is Bernardo's Tewfik Woodhouse. So he was adopted by Bernardo's at birth. His birth mum came over here to England, pregnant, had the kids over here, and then she disappeared back to Jamaica. So my dad was raised by my nana over in Bridlington and with my dad's twin brother, who's my uncle Carson. My nana's a remarkable woman. I could do the whole podcast about her. You know, she raised three black kids, my dad and his brother, my auntie Mandy, in an area where there's no black people for maybe 50 miles. You know, she's got pictures that I've seen that spray paint on her door, nigger lover and all things like that, brutal. People used to spit at her in the street. And she was in a house of real bad domestic violence. So she actually sent my dad and his brother back to Bernardo's for a few months until she got away from the relationship she was in. And once she was out of that relationship, went back to go and get him, which I find remarkable. And raised my dad and my uncle Carson and my auntie Mandy. And then later on, they moved to Driffield. My dad then met my mum. my dad was out one night and there was a massive fight and someone punched my dad. So this woman went over to my dad and says, "Oh, are you okay, love?" And he said, "Of course I am, you stupid cow." And that was my first thing my dad ever said to my mum. And then my dad seen my mum the week after in the pub. Because at that time, pubs were open every day. They were open Thursday, Saturday and Sunday, I think, in Driffield. And the week after, my dad was out with his mates. And one of his mates said, "Hey, it's that bird over there with the big tits." And that ended up being my mum. So that's how my mum and dad met. And then I came along, my brother and sister. And I was raised in Driffield, yeah. And I loved it. You know, when I talk about my childhood sometimes, it sounds pretty brutal. But I loved my childhood. It was amazing. Like I said, we had a next door neighbor but one who had a black Labrador called Nigger. But we were all friends. You know, that was just a word that was used in them days. And you either go home and cry about it or you deal with it there and then. So we were always fighting amongst each other. My house was a scary place to be brought up in.
Why?
Because my mum and dad would fight a lot. And a lot of my early problems came from dealing with that situation. You know, I remember still now, some of my earliest memories are sat up at the top of my stairs. We were born in a raised place called Northfield Crescent. My mum and dad would be fighting downstairs. Windows would be going through. Everything would be smashing. And I was petrified. And as the eldest child, I felt like my job is to look after my brother and sister. And that feeling of pure frozen with fear is something that still now I got a shiver down my spine when I talk about it, because I remember it like it was yesterday. And not being able to defend my family, I found really uncomfortable. It took me ages to kind of deal with it, the process of talking about it. I hadn't spoke about this until probably couple of years ago. So it's something that I've bottled up for ages. And it's difficult because my dad's no longer here, you know, and I didn't have a great relationship with my mum growing up. We're brilliant now. We get on great. So it was all really a difficult process for me to come through. But yeah, there was a lot of domestic violence in my house growing up. And that was hard and scary. I think it affects men I can't speak for women. I'm not a woman, but I think it's quite demasculating for a man. I don't know if that's a word, but it takes away that. I'm an old school bloke. You know, I feel my job is to protect, provide. You know, that's my job as a man. So as a young kid, to not be able to help was tough. And a lot of my early memories are of that. And that was tough. So that was kind of what I was brought up in. My mum and dad split up when I was 14 years of age.
How was that for you?
Yeah, difficult. I woke up one morning and I'll never forget. My dad said, your mum's gone. And I thought he meant he'd killed her. I honestly did. I thought my mum was dead. And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Hey, she's gone. She moved away and she'd gone with my brother and sister." So this was 1994. There's no mobile phones at this point. So when someone leaves and goes to like another town an hour away or an hour and a half away, whatever it is, I had no contact with my brother or sister or my mum, so I didn't know where they were. I didn't know what was happening. And that was difficult. My dad used to work away in London Monday to Fridays. So on Sunday night, he used to travel up. So I'm in the house at 14 on my own, 14 to probably 15, 16, on my own Monday to Friday. And my dad would come home on a weekend, and he used to work on the doors on a weekend. So I raised myself for a couple of years. I used to go around to my next door neighbor, but one's at the time called Kevin Edgar, who later died of a drug overdose. And we just used to doss about, stop going to school. So I left school really at 14 and was just kind of living on my own. So that was my upbringing. You know, I know a lot of people say sport saved them, but I was very, very fortunate that throughout all of this, one thing that I was always constant in my life was football. And I was always really good. So that kind of got me away from the situation. I moved over to Sheffield at 16 years of age and did an apprenticeship at Sheffield United where I was earning £42.50 a week. Mm-hmm. So that was amazing. And from 16 to 18 were probably the best 2 years of my life looking back.
Is that when you felt alive, free?
Chasing a dream. Yeah. You know, I always say to everybody that the journey is so much better than the destination. You know, all the stuff you're going through. So there's a group of 30 lads there. We all want to be footballers. Like I say, we're earning £42.50 a week. It's about nothing but chasing that dream. So them 2 years were so good. And within that first year, I'd made my debut for the first team, which was amazing. And I signed my first big contract. And then something that came into my life changed a lot of things, which was money. I'd never had money, never experienced money, didn't have a clue about it. I don't know if you guys have it up in Scotland, but we used to put a pound coin in the back of the television and you used to get 4 hours electricity. So that's kind of what we used to do. And when I signed my first contract at Sheffield United, I was having all this money come out of my bank account and didn't have a clue what was going on.
How much were you getting when you signed?
The first deal I signed at Sheffield United was on £1,800 a week. And then I got, I played and got in the team, started playing regularly, and my money went up to £3,000. I'm only 17 at the time. So that was a bit mind-blowing. And I remember ringing Kevin McCabe, who was the chairman at the time, like saying, someone's hacked my bank account. I've got all this money, like people taking money out of my account. I don't know. I've got no idea where it's going. So he rang the police and we had a meeting at Sheffield United and said, bring your bank statements in, your passport and all that. So I took it in. So the coppers are looking at it and they're looking at me like I'm an idiot. And they're like, we don't understand what you're saying. So like, I've got, look, that £1,000 gone out there. And they're like, they direct debits. And I'm like, what's a direct? I didn't have a clue what any of it was. And it was really, really difficult to deal with money. Talking about it now is embarrassing, but that was my reality.
Did nobody ever take you aside and try and get money management skills? Or
no.
To play in front of 30, 40,000 people each week?
No.
Have you just got to learn how to deal with it? Especially with you talking about the trauma of the past as well. It's obviously going to affect you because you've probably been used to your life full of chaos, anger, frustration, to then being in a friendlier environment, making some money legit.
Yeah.
It's an extra pressure that you think, fuck this, I'm actually used to being in chaos.
Yeah, and I remember when I signed my first contract, I think I got a signing on fee of £100,000 spread over 4 years, so £25,000 each year. So all of a sudden I've gone from £42.50 a week and then I get a bank statement, all of a sudden there's like thousands of pounds in there. And there's none of like, listen, spend it on this, spend it on that. All I'm thinking straight away is clothes, women, fast cars, you know, all the stuff that you dream of as a young kid when you're from a council estate, you've never had nothing. I remember when I first went to Sheffield United, I didn't own a pair of trainers. I had no trainers. I turned up in a tracksuit and shoes. So with my first pay packet, I bought a brand new pair of trainers and just little things like that I'd never had. So then all of a sudden, when you've got all this money, it blew my mind a little bit. And when I was 16, I got put on anxiety tablets by Sheffield United when I was 16. So
did they see signs of you being quite all over the place?
Yeah. So I went to the club doctor who put me on like tablets, but they were no good for me. And at the time, I always liked to drink anyway. It was normal. But they used to make me quite drowsy. So people just thought I was pissed all the time when I wasn't. I was just struggling a little bit. But these, it helped me sleep. It helped me settle down. Sleeping's always been a massive, massive issue for me. Because I panic in situations. I have really bad nightmares still to this day.
Do you think that's because of the domestic violence that was in the house?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because it's just not being able to settle. Because I used to sit up like praying, thinking, fucking hell, what's going to happen tonight? Is everything going to be all right?
Was your mum and dad drinkers?
Yeah. Yeah. So they both come in.
Steaming.
Yeah. And then sometimes it'd be all right and I could sleep. Sometimes it'd be carnage. You know, I love my dad. My dad's my hero. He took me all over the country with my football and I'm a real daddy's boy. But dad's also the scariest man I've ever been around in my life.
How was he when you signed for Sheffield United?
Yeah, he was buzzing. We went all over the country. Mm-hmm. Trials everywhere, trying to make something of my life, really. And whenever we had no money, we'd beg, steal and borrow for a tenner to get... You know, if we had £10 left, that £10 would go in the car so we could get to a trial. So my dad used to sacrifice everything to get me there. That's, you know, my dad was... Without my dad, I wouldn't have been successful in football because, like I said, he sacrificed everything. I love my dad and, you know, like I said, he's my hero. He's also scary. You know, when my dad loses his temper, he's a really, really scary man. So that was hard. So I struggled like mad with it. And it was a long, long process of trying to get over it. Yeah. Still now I have real bad nightmares now. I'm 41 years of age. So it's something I'm never going to get over. You just have to learn to live with it, really. But it shaped my whole life, you know, and it's so important. Like I do a lot of work with schools now and a lot of schools, you know, they have kids that are maybe not too naughty kids. And I know it's not the kids. It's what they're going back home to. You know, we have a massive responsibility as parents to do better.
Mm-hmm. What about how long were you on the anxiety pills for? What were they, Valium or anything? What were the kind of tablets?
I don't know what the exact word from were. 2 years.
Did you feel it? Did it make a difference on the field as well? Were you tired more,
just
less
helped
energy?
They helped me sleep and settle down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How was it when you says phases of 16, 18 was the best years of your life?
Because I was around loads of mates that were chasing the same dream. Mm-hmm. And I'm out of, bearing in mind that from 14 to 16, I lived on my own. I'm a kid, you know, I didn't even know. My dad used to leave like chicken legs in the freezer. We had a deep fat fryer. So I used to bang a chicken leg into it like 5 minutes, fry it, stick some rice with it. And that's what I did. I'm a kid. I didn't know what I was doing. So from 16 to 18, I lived in digs with a lady called Rita. And there's like seven or eight of us in there. So I've got my own little family again. You know, I've got people, I've got Rita who's cooking my meals for me. She was married to a Turkish guy called Ersin, who was a wicked cook. He used to all like the Turkish food and everything. So all of a sudden I've gone from absolute carnage. They had a massive house as well in a real like posh part of Sheffield. I'm like, fucking hell, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I used to actually nick wheel trims from Millhouses Lane. All really big cars up there. So as soon as I moved into this house, I'm like, I'm like a kid in a sweet shop. There's loads I can nick here. So we used to go up Millhouses Lane and steal wheel trims. And when I got into the first team, I'm nicking wheel trims, you know, so people are walking past and thinking, is that Curtis Woodhouse with a fucking wheel trim under his arm? But that was just the environment we were in. It was a buzz. I loved it. You know, it wasn't about the money. It was about whether I could get that off that Jaguar or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So I loved them 2 years because it was before I'd made it as well as a footballer. You know, I was earning good dough, but it's before no one knew who I was, so I could go anywhere. I'm in a big city. It was amazing. The best 2 years. I felt like I was like probably like how people feel like when they're in university or whatever.
Were you drinking heavy at 16, 17,
yeah.
18?
Yeah,
how
definitely.
Much?
No more than anybody else who was playing football at that age. So we'd have like a Tuesday night. It used to be student night. We always used to have Wednesday off. So we were out Tuesday, be out Saturday, Sunday. Probably four out of the 7 days.
It's a lot though.
Saturday, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then on Thursdays, I was one of them. I have to take everything to extremes. So some of the lads would go out after the game on Saturday, which was normal. But then I'd have to then go out Sunday. You know, Monday I'd be a bit ropey. So then I'd be out all day Tuesday. Wednesday we had the day off. So sometimes I'd go out Wednesday. And you're never allowed to drink 48 hours before a game. So Thursday was a no-go. So me being like fucking cleverest guy around, thinking, well, I'll go to Chesterfield on a Thursday. It's like 5 miles away from Sheffield. You know, it's not as if I'm going to the other end of the country. So I used to go out in Chesterfield, a place called Zanzibars on a Thursday, sober up Friday, play Saturday. So that was my routine from probably 17 to 25.
Do you ever look back and think if you'd fully dedicated yourself to your craft, how far you would have went?
All the time. But I've stopped playing that game now because I've kind of accepted that no matter what I'd have done as a young kid, would have ended up the same because I just wasn't emotionally ready to deal with the pressures of being successful. Being successful, you have to do a lot of things to do it. You have to be dedicated. You have to get into a good, healthy routine. You have to live a correct life. I just no way. I wasn't mature enough to do that. So no matter what I'd have done, it'd have crashed and burned. Whether it be football, whether it be working in a bank, whether it be in this or that. So I've stopped playing that game really, but obviously sometimes I watch TV and think, I wonder what I could have done.
Yeah.
And there's no worse feeling than that. And that's why I had to stop playing that game. Why you just beat yourself up, don't you?
What age did you get a call up for England, 21s?
Well, I played for England under 16s, under 18s, under 21s. So I went right through the age groups. So I genuinely thought I had a chance to go to the World Cup for Jamaica, but I genuinely thought I was going to play for England. You know, some of the players that I played with, I was on level par with, that went on to go and get loads of caps.
Was there at 21s with you?
So people like Frank Lampard, who was obviously a good player, but wasn't standout, you know what I mean? Jamie Carragher, Seth Johnson, Paul Robinson, who was from the area that I was from, just loads of like really good players, Joe Cole, some amazing players. So that was kind of my era, Steven Gerrard, all of the good ones, really.
What was their dedication like, seeing you were playing for under 21s and them? Were you still sneaking away and getting a drink, or were they head down? Because they seem focused, Gerrard's, Carragher's. They seem football, football, football.
Yeah. Well, I think the era that I came into it, so I came in at 96. So it was a norm to go out. And I've seen a few interviews with Steven Gerrard where he talks about, I think it was Gerard Houllier came into the football club and stopped all of that. Whereas I never had anybody do that. I never had that kind of positive influence on my football clubs. Probably because they're at Liverpool. I'm at Sheffield United. There's a difference. You can't play for Liverpool and be doing what I'm doing. Whereas, I know this sounds ridiculously arrogant, whereas I could play for Sheffield United and get away with it being half cut because my ability would take me through. But you can't get away with that. So I know they had a cut-off point. Like I said to you a minute ago, I've never had a cut-off point. My cut-off point had always as a young kid would be when I ran out of money. When you're on $3,000 a week, you're not running out of money anytime soon. So you don't really have a cut-off point.
Yeah, was there ever drugs involved?
No, I've never been one to take drugs. Smoke weed and stuff like that. I actually smoked weed on a pre-season tour with Sheffield United. There's four or five
you're
of
not
us.
Tripping balls.
Yeah, there's four or five of us sat on a beach in there, Trinidad Tobago. Split about that big. So that was that was interesting. But no, drugs has never really been a thing for me.
When did you go to Birmingham?
2001.
And that was for £1 million?
Yeah, I was 21 at the time, yeah.
Still young, big signing fee.
Young.
Very young.
Very young.
What was it like leaving Sheffield United?
I was happy to leave.
Why?
Because I was just in a terrible routine, like I'm talking to you. But there Saturday, all day Sunday, Monday sober up, all day Tuesday. I'm off Wednesday, so probably all day Wednesday. Sneak off to Chesterfield on Thursday, Friday sober up, Saturday play. Do it all over again. So I thought, I need to get out of this horrendous routine that I'm in. So I moved to Birmingham City, which was just as bad. Ended up on more money in a bigger city. So it's just like more, you know, more problems. More money, more problems.
Yeah. Did you ever look to speak to anybody, like to say, I'm really battling here. There's something not right. It's like, I'm constantly waking up, feeling down. So that's a bit of depression, anxiety.
Yeah.
Was there never a time where nobody spoke out at those times? It's not like now where people's kind of speaks out all the time. It's easy for people to speak out, but did you not realise that, okay, I need someone to talk to, or did you just try and hide it with?
When I look back now, I've probably suffered a lot more than what I realised. As an old man now, looking, old man, I'm only 41, but looking back, you see all the signs, but I didn't know. And football clubs, maybe different now, but football clubs don't care what happens if you're performing on a Saturday. They're not really interested in what you do away from that. There was no liaison officer or anything like that, or no one kind of to speak to. And even if there was, I wouldn't have done it anyway because I was, like, say, I'm old school. I'm only recently have I felt comfortable to talk about how I feel, you know, the situation sometimes that I feel in. You know, sometimes I have 3 days where I just can't get out of bed, just can't do it, but I just know how to deal with it now. You know, whereas before, it was mad. You know, I'd sometimes ring my dad like in tears and say, what's up? I say, I just, I don't know. I don't want to be here, Dad. I want to come home. I don't want to play football anymore. You know, and I'm old school. My dad's like even older school. So he'd be like, fucking hell. He said, I'm working on a building site here, getting paid £300 a week. You're fucking up in Birmingham on £15,000 a week. Grow up type of thing. So that was, it's not his fault. He doesn't know any better. And I didn't know any better. So I'm kind of thinking, yeah, he's right. You know what I mean? Okay, let's go for a beer. I'll feel better with a few beers, don't we? So that's kind of the whole cycle. And it just got worse and worse and worse.
What age were you when it really started to take its toll? When you start getting not as fit as you were and the beers and the drink, it starts really hitting its toll where the fitness starts to go a bit?
Probably 22. Like I say, if I had my time again, I'd have probably jacked at 22. Maybe even had a year away from football just to get out the whole the cycle of it all, really. But I was putting on loads of weight. I drink lager, so you know there's a lot of calories in it.
Yeah.
So and my game was getting around the pitch. I was always quite quick. I was strong. I was fit. I could run all day. I tackle for you. I was kind of an old school box-to-box midfielder. But what underpinned all that was my cardiovascular system. I was fit, I could run all day for you. But once that starts becoming, go from elite to bang average, then my game takes a massive, massive dip. And that's what happened. And I was no longer the player that I used to be. So then that kicks in them feelings of like disgust with yourself. What the fuck has happened here? You know, and then before I know it, I'm dropping through the leagues. you know, and I don't want this to sound disrespectful, but I know it does. And I fucking ended up at, like, playing in League Two on a Tuesday night at Leyton Orient, where there's like fucking 1,500 people there. I'm thinking, what has happened? How have I got to this? And it took me a long time, you know. I blame everyone. Every manager I ever played for, I hated. And then after a bit, you kind of realise that, like, I was unmanageable and uncoachable. And that was a big issue that I had. And once I kind of got through all of that and moved on to a different sport in boxing, it was easy. I learned how to handle that. But I was unmanageable, uncoachable. But the best thing I ever did was, I've managed to bounce back from that. How many players, you know, at a young age crash and burn and never, ever come back from it? And I managed to find something else and fall in love with something else and find a way back to living a healthy life and being a positive impact on other people's lives, which for a long time I never thought I would be.
Mm-hmm. So how did you end up getting over, like, 20 charges or different arrests? And what was the one, the cup final you missed, but you ended up smashing up the Indians?
Yeah, we played Liverpool in the Carling Cup final, and I was cup tags. I played for Sheffield United before, so I ended up going out all day, ended up drunk, and we ended up in a massive fight in an Indian restaurant and got charged with a fray. My solicitor told me I was looking at 18 months. So he said, if you plead not guilty, you're going to get found guilty. He says, you'll get 18 months for this. So I'd already been arrested so many times. I've never been arrested sober in my life, ever. Always when I'm pissed. And that was I think I'd just had my first son as well. He's 18 next week, he's big lad.
Shout out, happy birthday.
Yeah,
what's
happy
his name?
Birthday. He's called Kyle.
Happy birthday, Kyle.
Yeah, a little shitty.
Just like his dad did.
Yeah, I actually sparred him a couple of weeks ago. He fucking dropped me with a body shot. I can't believe it. So whenever I tell him, like, go do the dishes, he's like, you go and do the fucking dishes. So yeah, there's a new sheriff in town now. But yeah, he's 18. But yeah, it was, I nearly went to jail then, very close. And when I went to court, my solicitor told me, listen, take a wash bag on what you're kind of going to go to prison in. I was like, fucking hell. But luckily, the judge was lenient because he probably seen this kid's could have a bright future ahead of him.
Yeah.
We send him to jail, you know, it might disrupt all of that. So yeah, I got another opportunity.
Did that not give you the kick up the ass to say, okay, I need to knuckle down here. My life is slipping fast. What age were you then?
21.
So still a young kid. Was all this shit in the press, all over the press?
Yeah, yeah.
How was that extra pressure as well on your head?
Hard, because you kind of, I've got a reputation now as a wrong'un, you know, because I'd always been in loads of trouble at Sheffield United. A lot of it is laughed off when you're 17, 18 and just got into the team and then starting to become the best player in the team. It's all, like we spoke about before we came on air, a lot of it's brushed under the carpet because you're a commodity. We'll probably sell him on. I said I agreed a deal with Glasgow Rangers for £4 million. So no one's kind of like pulling you up on anything because you're a commodity. That's the way they see you. Just a piece of meat, really. But then as you become less and less of a commodity, the people start pulling you up and people start finding you. People start wanting to sell you and get you out the football club when you're not a commodity anymore. And at that time, no longer a commodity at Birmingham City. So when I ended up getting sacked. Yeah.
When did Rangers come in for you?
When I was 18 or 19, that sort of been, I think it was 1998, Dick Advocaat, who was a manager.
Great manager, man. Yeah, great some manager. Players, I think Newman, Van Bronckhorst,
yeah.
Gattuso's and Alberts, I think had some team then.
Great era. And I went up to Glasgow to meet the chairman. I was actually on the back of the Scottish Sun. The headline was Kirk caught in the act. So Glasgow Rangers agree a £4 million fee for Sheffield United's Curtis Woodhouse. So yeah, that's one of them sliding doors moments, isn't it? You know, of what might have happened if I'd have gone to Glasgow.
Is that what it was? £4 million?
£4 million, yeah. In 1998. So
you know, in the Versace Centre, strippers, booze, hotels. That's classic Glasgow, mate.
I went to the game. I think a lot of people in England don't understand how big Glasgow Rangers is.
Massive.
And both Celtic. Clubs, they don't realise how big the massive, clubs are. Yeah. And I was like, I'm 18-year-old kid, big Gazza fan. So it was a season Gazza had just left. And obviously Gazza ripped the league apart. So I've gone down there and I'm thinking, like, Sheffield United are a big club. I've gone to Glasgow Rangers and I couldn't believe it. It was the day that I think they beat Hearts, but they'd already won the league. So they were parading the trophy around the ground. The place was rammed. The atmosphere was like just unbelievable. So I've gone into like, they took me into the trophy cabinet in like the trophy room. It's fucking bigger than my house. There's probably about 1,000 trophies in there. I mean, Sheffield United, I think they've got like one trophy or something like that. So I couldn't believe it. So I went round and they were shaking my hand, like welcome to Glasgow Rangers. I just needed to sign the deal. It was all agreed, like a 4-year deal. And I'm really looking forward to it. So after the game, gone back to the hotel. And I was down there with a couple of agents as well. And Glasgow Rangers had sent like a couple of chaperones to take me around the city. They took me to, I went into the Versace shop. I don't really know Glasgow, but that well.
The Italian centre.
Yeah, yeah. So they took me around there and said, get whatever you want. And I got like a black pair of trousers. I didn't get anything else. So anyway, we went out on the night into Glasgow to kind of celebrate. I had a couple of beers before I know it. Like a couple of beers has turned into like drinking champagne. I'm drinking shots. And at this point, like when I left the ground, we went to, there's a pub opposite. The whole thing's blue and it's got massive paintings of all the old players in. So it was like loads of Rangers fans in there. So they're all like, oh, we can't wait to get you to Glasgow Rangers. What are you doing after? I says, I'm going out in Glasgow. We'll come with you. So at this point, I'm in Glasgow in this bar with about 50 Rangers fans. And we're just going around from place to place. And we end up at, I'm sure the place is called the Piano Bar. Is that a place?
Yeah.
A bar, Piano Bar. It's like a real like swanky bar, really like nice. By this point, it's about 10 o'clock. I'm pissed. So a guy's like playing the piano, singing a little bit of a few love songs, you know what I mean?
That would have been in Victoria's Art, the Corinthian piano bar.
Yeah, it's like amazing place. I'm bollocks at this point. And I'm like, give us another one. So they get like, everyone, shh. I'm like, fuck it. So I've gone and grabbed the mic off him at this point, like shoved him out of the way. I'm on the piano singing fucking Mustang Sally with about 50 Glasgow Rangers fans behind me. The place is absolute carnage. We've gone from there to the strip club. And I think it was like 2 o'clock, everyone was leaving. So we took all these women back to the hotel. There was more strippers in my hotel than there was in the strip bar. And we had like a massive suite there and we just wrecked the place. Ended up running, I think it was about $6,500 bar bill just at the hotel. Must say Dick Advocate. I'm out with two Glasgow Rangers chaperones as well. So they must be looking, I'm thinking, who is this maniac we've got here? So I've gone back to Sheffield. I've gone back to England on the Sunday. Gone in to see the chef. I've gone in at like 9 o'clock. So I've got a message. Chairman wants to see you. Something. So I've gone. I've only gone in to say bye to the lads, pick my boots up, and say, "Oh lads, all the deal's done. Listen, see you later," type of thing. Chairman wants to see you. Something. Obviously wants to say goodbye. So I've walked into his room, and you know when you see someone's face and you fucking know something isn't right. And he said to me, "He said, what have you done?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, what have you done this weekend? And I'm like, well, I went to the game and then went out for a few beers after. Few fucking beers? You've cost the football club £4 million and all the deal had all fallen through. I don't think it was just that. I think there was other things, agents and all things like that. But yeah, I think singing Mustang Sally in the piano bar on top of the piano, I don't think it helped.
That room full of strippers.
Yeah, but it was an expensive weekend, definitely. But I always think like what might have happened. It had probably been a bad move for me at that point because I'd have been on crazy amounts of money in a big city like Glasgow. I was there one weekend and nearly wrecked the place. So.
I don't think with your mindset back then, no matter what team you'd have went with, no matter what manager, even if a manager tried to help you, you'd have probably told them to fuck off.
Yeah.
I think you'd have just spiraled anyway. But it's not until later. But again, you're still here to tell the tale and you've had a phenomenal career. And any footballer would do anything to have half your career for what you've achieved. So you went from Sheffield United, Birmingham. What was it after that?
Well, I got sacked from Birmingham City.
What for?
I went on a 44-day bender.
As you do.
Which is impressive, you know. To wake up every day for 44 days and think, fuck it, I'm going again. You know, it was crazy, really. And Steve Bruce rang me up one time. I was in Tenerife. And he said, where are you? I said, I'm in Tenerife. He was like, you've fucking been gone 3 weeks. What is going on? When are you coming back? And I was like, I don't know. My head had gone at this point. Absolutely gone.
You ever suicidal then?
No, never felt like that. Just my head had gone. I just didn't want to be in that environment anymore. So I ended up I got sacked from Birmingham City. I still had like 2 years left on my deal. It just shows you, because you're not a commodity, they just want you off the wage bill. But if I'd have been worth money to them, they'd have somehow found a way to get me. I'm not blaming Birmingham City, you know, totally my fault. You can't go on a 44-day bender during a season, so I totally get all that. But I got sacked, and then I ended up going to Peterborough United, which changed my life, because that's when I met Gary Deroux, who's a former British featherweight champion, mm-hmm. or super featherweight, I'm not sure.
How old were you?
24.
Still young?
Yeah.
Still fucking it's crazy, young. It's as if you're at the end of your career at 35, 36.
Yeah.
But you're only 24.
I'm 24. Bonkers. And I was getting into trouble at Peterborough United. That's how it all started. I'd flare up during training and just want to argue with everyone. We Bobby Gould was the assistant manager. Remember Bobby Gould, who managed Wimbledon when they won the FA Cup? You know, been in the game for ages, respectable fella. I spoke to him like shit all the time. So disrespectful. Looking back now, it's one of the worst things that I feel more guilty about than anything. He deserves so much more respect. And I was a night, talk about unmanageable. At that point, Peterborough United, I was probably the worst I've ever been. I'd just cause fights every day in training just because I could, because I wanted to. And if anyone tried to stop me, I'd kick off, wreck the place, just boot balls off the training ground. When you look back, like I said, you know, if I'd have been older and more mature, I can understand there that kid's got an issue.
Were you not captain there as well?
Yeah, I was captain.
So
yeah.
That's not a very good leader, a negativity impact. So
I won player of the year. Mm-hmm. I won player of the year, fans player of the year, players player of the year. I know it sounds arrogant. I could do all that and still perform. We're in League One at this point. Fucking League One. I could play in League One now. Well, maybe not now. I'm struggling to get in the vets team at the minute, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But I know that sounds arrogant, but I could get away with it. League One was like fucking easy for me. Play it with my eyes closed. So I could get away with doing whatever I wanted and still be good enough to, like you said, be captain. And I'm a terrible captain. Awful leader at that point because I couldn't even control myself. So then you're trying to inspire other people around you with all these frustrations going on. And Barry Fry saved me, really. At this point, I'm volatile. I must be a nightmare to be around. I'm a ticking time bomb. So Barry Fry rang Gary Deroux up, who had a boxing gym in Peterborough, and said, "We got a player. Can you help us with him? He's a fucking nightmare." He said, "We can't do nothing with him. Won't listen to anybody. He quite likes his boxing." At the time, we had Leon McKenzie playing for us as well, who ended up being a boxer.
Boxer as well, yeah.
So if it kicked off in a game, we were fine, you know what I mean? Mm. So Barry rang Gary Deroux, and Gaz said, "Yeah, bring him down to the gym one day." And Gary was just what I needed, you know, tough bloke, former British champion, wouldn't take any of my shit for starters. And I looked up to Gary, and he took me under his wing a little bit, showed me a bit of care and attention, understood me a little bit, and we clicked. So I started just doing little things on the pads, bit of footwork, just to knock a bit of steam off, really, to try and settle me down on the training pitch. And that's where my professional boxing career started. That's when the thing in my head thought, I really like this, and I've always liked fighting. It took me a long time to admit I like fighting. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But when you say it out loud, it's like, ooh, sounds a little bit brutal, doesn't it? Mm. I enjoy it. Love fighting.
Was that taking you away from, was that getting all your aggression, frustration? You can do that in a football pitch to a certain degree, but you can't do it. It's different in a boxing ring because it's not only fighting your fears, it's the nerves. It's everything going into a fight, no matter. Listen, we do sparring up in Glasgow and I still get scared getting into sparring. No matter how long you do it, you're fucking scared. But after it, you feel like a man. You feel tough. Yeah. You feel like
Definitely. There's
no pressure. And for that few hours of that day, you feel great.
Yeah.
Like, because you're fighting. I think it's fighting your fears. I think it all boils down to is we're all scared as human beings. Like, you being the angriest man in the room is the weakest man, I believe. So you being angry and frustrating and fighting, if everyone shows me, okay, he's a bit vulnerable here.
Yeah.
Why did you think every year you get angrier and angrier and angrier? Is that because you've seen your career slipping and the people you played football with under 21 level have kicked on and cemented themselves as big players?
It took me a long time to realise why I was angry. I was angry at myself. I wasn't angry at anybody else. I was angry that how has this become this? How have I gone from there to here? I'm angry at myself. And like I said, you see everybody else who you played with, who you're just as good as, if not better at a younger age, and they're doing this and you're doing this. And Just angry at myself, yeah. And like I say, it wouldn't have mattered. It could have been Sir Alex Ferguson. It wouldn't have mattered who my manager was, and it wouldn't have mattered what I was doing at the time. I was destined to crash and burn, no matter what I'd have been doing, whether it had been football, boxing, fucking banker, whatever it was.
Yeah. How do you feel when you were doing all that shit? Was part of you feeling it was normal because you were so used to the chaos in your younger years, or did you realise what you were doing was wrong?
I knew what I was doing was wrong. Yeah. Deep down, I knew what I was doing was wrong.
Because when you hit 26, to retire at 26, you haven't even hit your prime. They say players hit their prime 27, 28, 29, 30. Even now, with things changing, the fitness levels, there's players playing in their 30s, late 30s. Look at Ibrahimovic. Look at, who's the Juventus goalie?
Buffon, yeah.
42, 43. Yeah, yeah. It's phenomenal crazy, that things are doing. But for you to make that decision at 26, was that a relief for you to retire?
Big time, yeah. Big Why? Time, massive relief. Because I just need to get out of that pressure keg of football. I just need to get out. So it was a massive weight off my shoulders. The last season I actually played was at Grimsby Town, and I played, I think, like 18 games for them with my old youth team manager, Russell Slade, who again was someone that when he went out of my life started to spiral out of control. I was scared of Russ. Russ was an old school youth team manager. But now in these days, you can't do the things that Russ used to do to us. It'd be classed as bullying or whatever. But Russ was fucking brilliant. You know what I mean? Russ had make you run through brick walls for him because we all respected and feared him as well. Fucking crazy bastard, Russ. But I needed somebody like that to keep me in check. So as soon as Russ left Sheffield United, he was another one that all of a sudden, I haven't got that fear factor. Fucking has loads of things. Like, Russ gets older, yeah. And Russ would get older as well. You know what I mean? He'd even join in training and smash you with elbows. And he used to come, like, train. He said, listen, fucking give him one today in training. And all things like that. But he was proper old school. Loved him. Great bloke. So he was a Grimsby Town manager. In fact, I'm missing out Hull City. So I went from Peterborough United to Hull City.
Mm-hmm. Your hometown?
My hometown club. So that was, for me, the last roll of the dice of, if I can't find that, whatever it is, back to my hometown club, a lot of my mates used to go and watch them week in, week out. Then I know I'm done. It's over. It took me a while to get into the team. First, like, 5, 6, 7 games I was on the bench. Got into the team. Started playing okay. Went out one night. End up having a fight with. I'm one of them. If I've done something, I'll be the first one. Yeah, fucking hell, my fault. But I've gone out. This kid started on me in the bar. I'd had literally one mouth of beer. I stood at the bar. He's pissed. He's been out. It was a Tuesday night, actually. We played Millwall on Sky Sports. We beat them 1-0, and I got man of the match. So I had no plans to go out. And I thought, I've just got in the team. So I thought, yes, I'm back in the game. Let's go out and celebrate, have a few beers. So I've gone out in Beverley and this kid started on me and we went outside. I went outside to leave and him and his few of his mates ran outside and started. And this guy fucking started throwing punches at me. So I hit him with one of the best shots I've ever thrown in my life. It made that noise and I knocked him out and he ended up breaking his jaw in 6 places. So we had the Wednesday off. I turned up to training Thursday. As soon as I pulled in, there's a fucking cop car there. And you just know straight away, don't you, that it was for me. So I've got my gear on, slid out the back, got into the training ground. As I'm doing the warm-up, police have come, arrested me on the training ground. I got charged. What did I get?
Serious assault?
Bad, yeah. And bearing in mind, I've got that phrase. Yeah. So at this point, I'm thinking, I'm doing jail here, 100%. Luckily for me, there was a girl in the bar who I know that's a special police officers, are they called? She's like a special PSO or something like that. She's seen it all. So she actually said, this was like a month after I'd been arrested and charged. So it goes to CPS, doesn't it, or something like that. Well, she actually went in and gave a statement and said, because the guy had said that he was having a burger outside and I'd just gone out and hit him. So I was like, that didn't happen. And they were like, well, that's what he said. You broke his jaw. You know, he's in a bad way. Da, da, da. I was like, fucking hell, this didn't happen. So the girl that was in there went and gave a statement saying, I was literally stood 2 meters from it all. Curtis sat at the bar having a drink. The guys come over, attacked him. Curtis put his beard on and left. And then him and his mates all ran out to try and get him. Otherwise, I'd have got...
Four years.
I'd have got a good few years, yeah. So I was so lucky that that lady was in there.
So would that come under self-defence or...?
I didn't get charged with anything. All charges were dropped. Yeah, because he'd attacked me for no reason. Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing anything. I'd literally had half a Budweiser. So it wasn't as if I was drunk and disorderly. And
was that all over the papers as well?
Yeah, yeah. So they'd even said like, oh, you've been boozing all day. I'm like, well, if you put Sky Sports on, I was fucking on there from 7:30 to 9:30. And this incident happened at like 10:10. So say I've had 40 minutes. I've got to get a shower. I've got to get from Hull to Beverley, which is 20 minutes, which leaves me 10 minutes to get pissed. You know what I mean? So it is what it is. But luckily, but at this point, bearing in mind, I've already gone to Hull City with a bad reputation anyway. Peter Taylor's my old England under-21s manager. So he's kind of thought, well, let's give him a final chance type of thing. And this took ages to come out with what actually happened. By the time it had come out, the club had already thought, we can't be dealing with this. And they ended up paying me up. And Russell Slade, who was at Grimsby Town, rang me and says, will you come and play for us till the end of the season? I said, I'm done, Russ. I'm retiring. He's like, what do you mean you're retiring? You're fucking 25. He said, come and play till the end of the season. I said, I'll come, but I promise I'm going to retire. I'm going to become a professional fighter. So he was like, fucking hell, what's he doing now? So I ended up going to play for Grimsby. But I'd already made that decision that I was done. So playing them last 18 games, I played really well for Grimsby.
Get them in the playoffs?
Yeah, we got beat in the playoff final, yeah.
How many people at Wembley?
It was at Cardiff. Wembley was getting redone at the time, yeah.
How many people?
I'm not sure. It was Grimsby versus Cheltenham.
Yeah.
Not many. Probably had a shower in front of more people. but it was good to bow out. My eldest son was at that game as well. But yeah, we lost. But I played well because I knew it was over. So I could just relax and just think, I'm just playing football for the last 18 games of my life. I'm never going to play again.
That's sad to see that, Curtis. Like 25 years old to think that, especially with your son... They're playing at one of the biggest stadiums on the planet, Millennium Stadium, to thinking, this is me retiring and feeling like it's a relief. It's like people who are going to commit suicide. I've worked with a suicide centre in Scotland called Chrissy's House, and the people who have tried to commit suicide but not, the day it ends up falling through, but the day they know they're going to commit suicide, they feel happier than they've ever been.
That it's over.
That it's over. Mm. And it's you at 25 to think that this is my last game and you feel even happier. Yeah. It's mad that to think that.
I understand that feeling that you just spoke about. It was a massive relief. I was so glad it was done. That I'm not having to torture myself over like, because you know, everything that went wrong in my career was my fault. So I hadn't even got anyone to blame. I can't like blame injury. I had a couple of injuries, but nothing like that affected my career massively. I've had seven operations on my left knee. But nothing that, like, I can say, if my knee hadn't gone, this, and this. So I had nothing to blame it on apart from my own ill discipline and circumstances, you know. So that's difficult to deal with, having to look in the mirror and know that your shortcomings are your own doing. It's hard.
Yeah, it happens, though. But what age did your old boy pass away?
So my dad died when he was 52.
How old were you?
So I'd have been 28.
So after you retired, but he still get to see you fulfill your potential and live your dreams and do that. So listen, football's not everything. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
But I must admit, it must have been frustrating for my dad.
Yeah.
To watch his son coming through as a teenager, talked about as a hot prospect, to then be watching me at Leyton Orient in front of one man and his dog. So to see that drop off. And when I retired, I felt guilty as well because my family gave a lot for me to get here and I've pissed it away. My career, I should have been able to retire and make the next 3-4 generation of Woodhouses financially comfortable. That's the reality of what I should have done, but that's not what happened. So that guilt of feeling like you've let people down, That was hard.
Yeah, but hindsight's a wonderful thing. As you say, we can't always concentrate in the past, but what happens is for your son who's turning 18, if my dad can make play in the Premiership, he can be a British champion. Your career's not that bad, brother. Yeah. That kind of eventually spur on your son's kids, your grandkids to go, he can do it. So no matter what you've done in your life, people can still take inspiration from it. Yes, yeah. You were the bad boy of football. You've probably had to live up to that reputation every team you went, and then you've done fuck it. But it takes a lot of balls to retire at 26,
yeah.
Knowing that you haven't even hit your prime yet. So for you to make that transition to then quit football, to then get into boxing, what was people saying? They think he's fucking lost his mind.
I was a laughing stock, yeah. I was a laughing stock. It was like, everyone was like taking the piss. But I've always been very bullheaded. The more people took the piss, the more it kind of lit a fire underneath me. And honestly, I genuinely thought that that I was good. I didn't realise I was really bad until the bell went for my first ever fight. I was fighting a guy called Dean Mark Antonio, and Dean Powell was my manager. Dean's not with us anymore. He actually committed suicide.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And he was a great man, boxing through and through, and he was my first ever manager. I was signed with Frank Warren, and they says, we found your first fight, just like a week before the fight. So I'm thinking, fucking hell, they haven't got me anyone to fight yet. So they rang me up, got you someone, Kurt, brilliant. I was like, all right, class, who is it? Like, it's called Dean Mark Antonio. And I said, fucking no chance. I'm not, that ain't happening. He's like, what do you mean? I said, I've never had a fight. You can't chuck me in with a Mexican. He'll fucking kill me. And he said to me, he's not a Mexican. He's a fucking window cleaner from London. He said, he's the worst kid we can find. He said, he boxed one of our lads last week, and our lad's shit. And he made him look like Sugar Ray Leonard. He said, if you can't beat this guy, he says, there's fucking nothing we can do with you. And I remember coming back after the first round of fighting, the worst guy they can find, thinking, I think I've lost that round. So it was a realization of, it's absolutely fine chinning someone in a nightclub when you're healed up. But there's a big difference between that and boxing when you've got a sky camera in front of you and you're doing something against someone who's been doing it since they were 10 years of age. And I've only ever had a fight when I'm drunk. Then all of a sudden I have to do it sober. The nerves, the pressure of it all. And I realised I'm really bad at this. And I end up winning I beat Dean Mark Antonio by, I think it was 1 point, and I knocked him down twice. So I just scraped through. Hmm. And it was a real humbling experience. And that's what boxing did for me more than anything. It humbled me really, really quickly. Really quickly. And that's the beauty of the sport, and I love it. And it's such a tough sport. You know, there's no money in it. People see like Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury, that they're going to split like 150 million. They think we all get that. Fighting for peanuts.
How much did you get?
For that fight. So I got paid $2,500 for that fight.
How much were you getting at Grimsby a week?
About the same.
So you're getting that weekly, but you got that for a 10-week training camp, paying trainers, playing managers. Yeah. You probably walked away with fuck all.
Yeah.
Did you feel happier?
Yeah, I felt like I'd achieved something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because even though I beat Dean Mark Antonio and he was rubbish, I was rubbish as well.
And that was on the telly?
It was on ITV, yeah.
Kevin Mitchell in that fight that night?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Shout out to Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you'd lost that fight, do you think you'd have kicked on? Or do you think you'd have quit?
I fucking don't know how to box after that.
He's ranked 189, 190.
Yeah, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
But
is that what he was ranked 189 and you were ranked 190?
Yeah, so when the British Boxing Board of Control rankings came out the week before. So there's 187 fighters in my weight category. And I was ranked 187th and he was ranked 186th. So it's like the donkey derby, you know what I mean? And you know what pissed me off? Like, when I beat him, they kept me where I am and kept him where he was because they thought, oh, I'm not sure even if he won that. So I beat him and still didn't move up a place. So it was madness.
What was the press treat you like?
Yeah, they're awful.
Bad?
They all took the piss, yeah. I remember reading the headline the day after saying, I wonder where the circus stops next. Because I was the first one. Obviously, you've had Freddie Flintoff come out and box, Rio Ferdinand.
He
said he was going to, but his ass fell out. Probably got hit on the nose and thought, not sure about this. Obviously, Leon McKenzie boxed and did well in a short space of time. But Leon's from a family of boxers, you know. So I was kind of the first one to come out. So the press were like pretty brutal towards me. But even in the build-up to it, I was like, yeah, it's all right. You wait till they see me box. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, fucking hell, this kid's brilliant. And then, like I said, one round in, I'm all over the place. So they must be like, oh, this kid's shit. So they were all taking the piss out of me. So that was difficult as well, because no matter what happened in my football career, people had always genuinely accept that I'm a good player. So there's always the only negative press I'd get was when I'd get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, normally the match reports,
yeah.
I'd normally play all right.
How was that for you, going through racism as a young kid, all the torment of other people, to then try to do something with your life in the press, writing negative comments? How does that affect you mentally?
It was difficult because I felt like they weren't giving me a fair crack of the whip. Give me a chance, you know what I mean? Don't, you know, these kids have been doing it since they were 10 years of age. I've not put a pair of gloves on until I was 26. I thought they'd have been a little bit more sympathetic, but it kind of felt like everyone wanted to stick the knife in as soon as they possibly could.
But with your character, is that not a case of, okay, fuck you, I'm going to show you?
Yeah,
and you exactly end up that. Kicking on. So you end up winning your first 10 fights, is that correct?
First 9.
Yeah. How are you feeling after that? Are you feeling I'm going to be world champion?
Yeah. I'm big in...
But that's some feat in itself,
yeah,
for putting the gloves on at 26. And then no matter who you're fighting, anybody can win a fight, I believe, yeah, anyway. But to win your first 9 fights, but you're then thinking, okay, I've got something here.
Well, if you go into Iceland now and mention my name, I'm big over there. Because mm-hmm. anyone that's around about 10'7" that's from Iceland, I've dusted them off. You know, we got all the shit fighters, all of them from everywhere. Yeah. But yeah, I was getting better. You know, I was getting better. I wasn't matched hard. You know, but I was learning on the job. And then I fought a guy called Jay Morris, who actually had the audacity to start punching me back. And I was like, well, what's going on here? This isn't how it works. Jay was tough, like a rugged journeyman. Had been around the game for a long time, been in with some good fighters. And he just outmanned me. Simple as that. He was just too tough for me at that time. It's amazing what happens to your body once you've been a pro for about 5, 6, 7 years. It becomes like that. It's fucking hard. Rock solid. Your body's hard. You're conditioned. I'd been a footballer for 10 years, so my body was like jelly. You know what I mean? It just wasn't that teak. You know, fighters have got a...
Yeah, solid.
They're different, you know. And he was teak tough. And I was still had the little footballer's body, really. And he just shoved me about. He beat me by 1 point. It was a close fight. I was devastated. It was on Satanta as well, live on Satanta. That one hurt, yeah. It's like everything, the first one's always the hardest to take, isn't it? And I did the usual. I retired and that was it. I'm done. Fucking judges, fix, blah, blah, blah. Then after I kind of got my head out my ass, I thought. It was actually Adam Booth that saved my career at that point. He rang me up the next day and he was like, how do you feel? I'm like, I'm gutted. He said, I'm done. I'm retiring. If I can't beat Jay Morris, you know, I'm never going to be British champion, am I? Because I'd come out and said I'd win the British title within 2 years, me being a fucking idiot. So I'm like, Jay Morris at that time had like won 6, lost 20 odd. If I can't beat Jay Morris, like, what am I going to do? And I'll never forget, Adam said to me, he said, have you heard of a fighter called Muhammad Ali? I'm like, yeah, obviously. He said, you know, he's lost 5 fights, don't you? I'm like, yeah. He says, so Muhammad Ali can lose 5, but Curtis Woodhouse can't lose 1. He said, like, get your head out of your ass, you know, get back in the gym. There's loads you need to work on. Fucking get on with it type of thing. And I put the phone down. I was like, yeah, he's right. You know what I mean? What am I going to be the guy that then runs away from football, that then runs away from boxing, that then runs away from this? I didn't want to be that guy. So I had to dig down deep and swallow a bit of pride and fucking get on with it. Yeah. And I did.
Do you think you can run away too easily? Throw the toys out the pram a bit?
No, I don't think I can. Like I said, that's just a perception people have had. I've never ran away from anything in my life, but he's left football, now he's leaving boxing. I knew that that'd be the perception of what people would have of me, and I didn't want to be that guy. So I didn't want to be that guy that walked down the street and people were like, that's Curtis Woodhouse, and he lost his first fight and fucking did a runner. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah. When did you get the British title chance? How many fights in?
8 years in. So
that's a long journey as well.
35 fights in.
Is that how many you've had? 35, lost 7?
I came back, didn't I? I had 3 more, so I think I've had 38, yeah.
That's fucking a lot of fights in only a short period of time. Many fights we have in a year? 3, 4?
As many as I can, really. Because at the time, I've got no income.
Yeah.
I've got no source of income.
Did you have any savings or anything? Or did you spunk it all?
I had some, but not what I should have done.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't last forever, does it?
Mm-hmm.
Got a wife and 3 children to provide for. Big house, fast car, all the football stuff. And then all of a sudden, I'm fucking fighting tooth and nail for 1,500 quid per fight or whatever. So it doesn't go far. Uh-huh.
See, when you started getting fitter, though, 28, 29, when you were doing the boxing, did you ever feel like jumping back into football?
I played a bit of part-time football to provide a wage. Mm-hmm. I could still play at a decent
Dagenham
level.
Redgrave.
And I played for Rushden and Diamonds.
Rushden and Diamonds.
They were chucking like crazy money about at one point, so I jumped on that gravy train and
that was
fun. But yeah, I was done. I just seen it as just a source of income.
Mm-hmm. What about when you won the British title? How was that feeling for you to prove everybody wrong that it could be done for the first guy to ever go from football to boxing to then winning a British title, which is a phenomenal achievement.
That's the thing. It'll never ever be done again. Never. Impossible. It's as close to impossible. So you go and watch England under 21s. You watch the next game that they play, and think one of them is going to become a British boxing champion. It would just never happen. I was immensely proud, and not even because of the destination, like we spoke about. It's the journey. I lost 6 fights on my way to go there. 6 opportunities to retire, to quit. I got knocked out twice. I got ridiculed the whole way through, apart from maybe the last 18 months before I won the British title. I think people started to think, I mean, I boxed Steffi Bull, who'd had like 40-odd fights at the time, beating him some good kids. I stopped him in 9 rounds. I then went and boxed Frankie Gavin, who's like the UK's greatest ever amateur. I lost on a split decision. That was when people thought, fucking hell. I was 100-1 to win that fight. In a 2-horse race, the disrespect is unbelievable. You know what I mean? I was 100-1 and I lost on a split decision. But even after that, it was all, Frankie Gavin didn't perform, didn't train properly, blah, blah, blah. It was never like, okay, no, Curtis actually boxed well that night. And then I went on and I beat Dave Ryan, tough man, for the English title. So at this point, that's the beauty of boxing. When the bell rings, the truth is always told. There's no bullshit. You win or you lose, and people see how you fight. So it's not, I'm beating and competing with good kids. So whether they want to give me the respect or not, they have to, because I'm getting in with good quality fighters. So I was starting to get, fucking hell, this kid's not bad. And then obviously the opportunity to fight Darren Hamilton was a massive one for me. And it was literally a stone's throw away from where my dad died. So that was huge. Losing, I feel real bad saying this, but losing my dad was the reason I won the British title, because it gave me a reason to carry on doing it. Because it was the last thing I ever said to my dad, that I promised him that I'd do it. So having that burden to carry was hard. Because like I said, my dad's my hero, always will be. Like I said, the scariest man I've ever met, and some things I could tell you that it'd be, you wouldn't believe it, but they're all true. But he's also, like we all are, a product of his own environment. You know, to be left on Bernardo's doorsteps at 6 weeks of age, not know who his family are, to be in a complete white area, to get racially abused most of his life until he kind of starts fighting back. So my dad had his issues as well. So, and he came through them all and became a respectable kind of guy. So my dad's my hero. So I didn't want the last thing I ever said to my dad to not come true. So to actually win the British title was, again, felt like the day I retired from professional football. Thank God for that. Because, you know, speaking about nightmares, not being able to sleep, I've then got that fucking hell, like my hero, and I've like, the last thing I said is a lie, it's bullshit. Every time I lost, that feeling, it drags you down and it's really debilitating. So to get that moment where I'm the new, it was, thank God for that. I'd hate to think what my life would be now without winning the British title. It wouldn't be good.
Yeah. Do you think you would still be here?
I don't know. I've had dark moments. You know, I've been through some really, really tough parts of my life that I've never really spoke about to anybody. As soon as this is my last ever podcast that I'm ever going to do. It's been tough at times. And yeah, I'd hate to think I'd have been. Just struggling to deal with your past and having to accept what you've done. Loads of bad things that I've done that I'm not proud about, never spoke about. And they're hard to deal with at times. And like I said, on top of that, if I hadn't have kept that promise, that'd have been tough.
Yeah, I know you've got kids, I know you've got your missus and that, but was it the boxing that kind of changed your life?
And it's a bit of a cliche to say boxing saved my life, because it didn't.
Yeah,
I saved my life.
Of course, man.
You know what I mean? I take credit for it myself. Mm. And it could have been anything. If I'd have bumped into Steve Redgrave, I might have ended up being a rower. But I was fortunate that I met Gary Daru. You know, and being... I'm a big believer in you are the company you keep. And all of a sudden, once I started to step away from football, I'm no longer in a drinking environment. People don't booze in boxing. Fucking game's too hard and serious. You're not out 3-4 days a week on the piss. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, I'm around different people. I'm around inspiring people. I'm looking at like, fucking this guy, superhero. I want to be like him. So I changed my life. Nobody else. Yeah. No, nothing else. No other sport. I had the gumption to do it myself. That's the thing I'm really, really proud about. Like I said, how many loads of people fall by the wayside and never come back. And I came back.
Yeah, you see the guys in the pubs and it's I could have been a contender. I could have made something. But you have played at the elite level.
Yeah.
In all departments and every sport you've jumped in, you've got that mindset, but it's that other mindset with the self-doubt and the thinking you're not good enough. But that comes, people need to understand actually what you've came through, the racial abuse, the hostile environment in a household where you're probably, you says earlier, you can't sleep at night, and that affects you, the trauma affects you for eternity. It's trying to break the connection. So when you think about that pain, the emotion isn't there as much, but that comes with, I don't know, therapy. I've never done therapy myself, but maybe going to try it myself also. It's something that I'd really like to work on and go to deeper levels and work on inner child as well. But for everything you went through, you've still had a great career. You've proved all the doubters wrong, but I believe that's when you perform better, is when you're underdog, when everybody doubts you, because that's when you start making something of your life, you start taking the foot off the gas because you've fucking accomplished that. I always use Tyson Fury as prime example. That he won all the belts, most famous man on the planet, undefeated, hurt the biggest depression in his life.
Yeah.
Because when he set that goal and achieved that,
it's done.
They're not, it's done. What is it? That's not, wait a minute, I still not feel fulfilled here.
Yeah.
I don't feel complete. Because when you get these things, it is external stuff.
It's like I've said to you during this interview, the journey is so much better than the destination. Of course.
It's to enjoy it though.
Yeah.
And that's the fucking difficult part, because we concentrate on a finishing line. When we get the finishing line, we create another one.
Yeah.
And then for, you know what, time flashes that fast. Yeah. And then we're 50, we're 60, but you've still got memories to live. Your kids have seen you playing at football stadiums. Yeah. Your mum's seen you win British titles. So it's still a great thing. Like, I do these podcasts. I know my mum enjoys them. My friends at work say, oh, I'm watching James's podcast. And she feels that good. It's just that wee bit of goodness to try and help others around you to feel good because you're achieving something, which is a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that I've done so much better in later life is being able to communicate, being able to talk about different things. And that's a massive, massive help. It, like you said, it is kind of a therapy. But I think it takes a long time to deal with, as men, to deal with things and be able to get them out. Because you feel like, God, I hope people don't think I'm a pussy.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of environment and background that I'm from. So, but yeah, it took me a long, long time to feel, what's the right word I'm looking for, comfortable within my own skin. That's why I can talk about anything. I can talk about anything now and I don't feel nervous. I don't feel embarrassed. I don't feel bad about talking about my past. If I'm in the most violent situation happens out in the street, my heart rate don't go up by like one beat. And that's a terrible thing. Yeah. I think that's really bad.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever done counselling or therapy?
No.
Have you ever spoke to anyone?
I'm similar to you though. It's on the list.
Yeah.
I think I've got a lot of things I still need to get better
I've been trying to do it for 2 years. I went once about 3 years ago. And I done fuck that. I'm not going back.
Yeah.
It's fucking scary now. We can sit here and talk about the pain of the past, but there's stuff that we'll not speak about in front of camera because there's still something there. We need to speak to somebody who we can trust. And I think the day we truly do that is the day we'll truly heal.
Yeah.
I believe.
I've got a couple of things that I've never ever spoke about.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I ever would. When I wrote my book.
Yeah, Box to Box.
Yeah. When I wrote that, I just thought I'm just not ready to quite go there yet.
Yeah.
You know.
But there will be a time when you'll feel ready.
Maybe.
When I believe, like, there's stuff that I won't speak about, there's stuff that I'll take to the grave also, but like I always say, I'm open and this and that, but there's still something me holds back because we're worried how other people perceive.
Perception.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
You know what, and I actually spoke to my mate on the way down here. Shout out to Wardy.
Big
fan of yours. Uh-huh. I could tell you some stories about him, by the way. Fucking hell. This would never be able to go live if I did. But what was I saying then? Yes, I spoke to Wardy on the way down here about, it's going to be my last ever podcast, so I'll speak about most things, but I've got a life outside of this as well. There's some things I don't want my kids to know, future kids that I'm working with as well, even though it might be good for them to hear me talk about certain situations and certain things that I've done, which are terrible, but I don't know. Like you said, perception of how people are going to look in. I work with a lot of schools, a lot of naughty kids that are from bad backgrounds, not difficult backgrounds. It all starts in the home. You know, all the problems kids have come from the home because you are the company you keep. But yeah, I'm not sure I'll ever be quite ready to put it out there because, like I said, people look in and judge.
Mm-hmm.
And if I told you certain things, people would say, he's a fucking disgusting human being. So I'm not quite ready to go there yet.
Yeah, but you've been judged your whole life, so you know
yeah.
what it feels like, and the pressures of success. It's not just about having a talent and being successful. It's can you deal with the pressures, the outside noise, people's opinion, especially with social media kicking off.
Yeah.
I think you probably came out and retired when social media was just kicking off. So can you imagine at that time, everything in the papers, you know what they say, the papers have wrote much shit about me and it's fucking been bullshit.
Yeah.
But you just accept it. So everybody's got an opinion. Somebody will throw back in your face what you've done and it's an opinion.
That opinion then becomes fact.
Yeah.
You see it that many times, you read it that many times, people assume that that is actually true.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, social media is the devil, isn't it?
You actually met a troll on live TV.
Yeah.
What happened?
I nearly killed him. I was going to batter him. So I put out a post. It was actually the day after I lost my English title. So I put out a post saying, just doing the school run, have a great day, everyone. And he put a post back out saying, you want to be careful where you drop your kids at school, you never know who's watching. That's what he put. So I'm like, there's a certain line, isn't there? I don't mind being called shitbox or shit footballer online. I don't mind all that's water for ducks back. But once people start putting what I class as a threat to my family, I thought, I'm not having this. So I put on Twitter, I put a bounty on his head. I said, I'll give anyone £1,000 who tells me who this guy is. I had his name, address, and everything within 5 minutes. Somebody that messaged me, how can I put this? Had the deeds to his house. So he sent me like where he lived, everything. So I put it up on my social media and I sat and had his address and I was 47 minutes away. So I said to him, I'll see you in 47 minutes. And I was just on my way there. And Joey Barton retweeted it. It's got like 6.5 million followers. And John Prescott, you know, the politician from Hull, he's a guy who, someone egged him, didn't they? And he hit him with a 1-2. He tweeted saying, this is how we deal with shit in Hull. So it was crazy. Then like Lorraine Kelly got hold of it. Lorraine Kelly, I went on a Good Morning Show the week after. I got fucking paid more for going on that than I did for my English title fight. So it was bonkers. But I just went and tracked him down and he gave a grovelling apology. But people can't just say whatever they want to say, can they? That's not how life
it's
works.
It's abuse.
And you know what? When I've been out in town or I'm in a bar or whatever, no one ever says anything to you, do they? Everyone just comes up and says, oh, hiya, mate. I seen your British title fight. I was there that night.
Everybody's nice,
It's madness, isn't it? And then you go on social media, like, where are all these guys?
Because I was doing a thing up in Glasgow. I was doing like a reality show kind of thing. And when it just started, somebody was giving me proper shit. And I thought, nasty bastard, because that was the first I'd ever tasted any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, nasty, like, and I was saying, talking about some nasty shit about my kids and stuff. And I says, I'm going to fucking batter you. Like, I was wanting his number, this and that. Forgot all about it, but I actually seen him. We were up in there's a place called The Fort in Glasgow, and I'd never forgot it because I couldn't sleep in that. I'm thinking, what if this is real?
Yeah,
it was my first proper threat. Seen him, say, what are you saying now, dickhead? Oh, sorry, big man. Just fucking slapped him, just slapped him, put him in his place. But you need to learn not to do that shit also because you know all these people are cowards, and it is as you get older and the more you learn. But you shouldn't have to accept that sort of pish. 100%. That talk shit, get banged, I believe. Yeah, do you know what I mean? So, but fair play to that kid for coming on the telly with you.
Well, because it depends on what you got paid, doesn't it?
Did they get dough for it as well? So he's making money off giving people abuse.
You know what, I didn't even know he was going to be on the show. So I was going on Lorraine Kelly to talk about trolls and all things like that. So I've gone up to London the day before. As most of my stories start off, we were in London. I'm a northerner. We don't get to London much. So I decided to have a few beers. So we're on the breakfast show. It's like 6 in the morning they get you in. So they picked us up. I'm getting makeup done. Lorraine's coming. She's a pretty little thing, actually, Lorraine. So she is, and she smelled lovely. So Lorraine came in and says, oh, Curtis, I just want to let you know that we've got James on the show as well. So bearing in mind, I'm hungover. I'm like, what? She said, oh, yeah, he's on the show. So I'm like, right? And she says, and I'll never forget, she says, I just got to let you know that this isn't Jeremy Kyle. That we haven't got any security. So I'm like, if he starts talking, I'm gonna lay him out clean live on breakfast television. So she's gone, are you going to hit him? I'm like, depends on how he deals with it all. So she's like panicking. So she turned around. I seen her run back into his room. And she's come back in 2 minutes later. She's going, no, he just wants to say he's really, really sorry. He said he don't want any like violence or confrontation at all. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, well, we'll kind of see how it goes.
Did you speak?
I didn't know what he looked like at this point. Uh-huh. So I'm thinking, fucking hell, he's not a big lump. You know what I mean? And he walked out and I felt bad actually because he's like a youngish kid. And he was shitting himself. He was a bag of nerves.
Yeah.
And he came out and just said, sorry, blah, blah, blah. But just going back to what you said, do you not think when these people are abusing you, and it's easy to kind of fire back at them, but do you not think that these probably got a lot going on as well?
Yeah. No, it's a reflection
of them.
They're
not in a good place.
Yeah, no, that's them projecting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And a lot of them are mentally disturbed. Like, I get crazy messages. We get fucking 10,000 messages on all platforms each week. So it's a lot of messages. And you look at messages, you go, nah, you're not right in the fucking head. And
I bet 99% of stuff you get is positive.
It's all love.
But it's that one.
But I concentrate on the 1% and I think you mug.
Sticks with you.
Yeah, and then you think 2 weeks later and then they pop into your head again and you want to see them. But it can steal your energy straight away. It can ruin your whole day. And obviously, you do get used to it.
Yeah,
you do get used to it. And it
get numb to it all.
Yeah,
though,
and you kind of. But it makes you kind of recluse as well. It makes you kind of, it's a lonely journey trying to be successful as well. Like I only interview people.
Do you know why?
Why is that?
Because not many people are successful.
Yeah.
There's not many people that are. So people that are, people look in and whether you're the same as them, but you're doing good stuff and they don't fucking like it. And that's why it's lonely on the top of a mountain, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the horrible thing. Like I will support anybody and I genuinely mean that. Like, but if you fuck me over, I'm done. But when you become successful, you start seeing people turn against you. The people who can't get to your heights become envious.
Yeah.
When you were doing your boxing stuff, was it a lonely journey or did you...
Well, no, most of it, I was shit.
I wouldn't keep saying that though, because you won the fucking British title.
Yeah, I got there in the end.
And what happened after the British title? Did you lose it to, was it Willie Limond?
Willie Limond, yeah.
I know Willie, he's a good friend as well.
I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, good guy, man. Fucking bonkers. He put Can in his ass. He should have beat Can. I think Can got an 11 count or 12 count as well. And
he's down a while, wasn't he?
He sparred him with Ricky Burns as well, another good Scotsman.
What a long week that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... yeah, they rang me up. He was fighting Michael Katsidis, was Ricky Burns. Like a come forward, strong fighter. So they rang me up and said, it was Billy Nelson rang me up and said, would you come and spar with Ricky Burns? Ricky Burns like a super featherweight at the time. I'm a welter. So I'm like a stone and a half, 2 stone heavier than him. And Billy said, we'll pay you $1,000 a week. I'm like, I'll fucking stay there a month if you want, Bill. So he said, yeah, come up and spar with him. So he said, we want you to do 8 rounds Monday, 8 rounds Tuesday, Wednesday off, 8 rounds Thursday, 8 rounds Friday. So I'm thinking, Ricky Burns, like super featherweight, not really a puncher. Fucking easiest £1,000 I've ever earned in my life. So they picked me up from, I think it was Glasgow they picked me up from, train station. Ricky's like the nicest guy ever, you know what I mean? He picked me up in this like fucking Nova 1.2, this massive, he's like a body racer. So I'm chatting away, fucking brilliant, da 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 da. I'm thinking, wow, easy money this. So we've got in, bell went. He's a vicious bastard, is Ricky Burns. When the bell went, he was like trying to take me off. I'm like, where's that Ricky from a couple of minutes ago? But you know what? What that taught me is that elite mentality. And bearing in mind, I'm fighting 6 and 8 rounders at the time. So when we sparred, he'd get out, he'd do a circuit, and he'd go for a run. And I'm thinking to myself, like, he's miles better than me, which I can accept. I knew that before I got up here. There's no excuse for him outworking me, you know, doing like the circuits and the running after. And after sparring, I can't hardly move. So when I went away from that, that made me think, I've got to work harder.
Yeah.
Look at this guy. He's getting the maximum out of himself. Because you look at Ricky Burns, you're not looking at like a Floyd Mayweather. Ricky's got the maximum out of the ability he's got. Yeah. And I love that in him. Mm-hmm. You know, I respect that so much in him. And he's a real nice guy, but yeah.
Freeweight world title.
Yeah, he beat the shit out of me. Yeah. I was meant to be up there for 2 weeks, but he cut me under both eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so me saying I'd last a month, joking at
happy
you.
To go after the week.
First day, I'm like, mate, I'm laying him, put my head on the pillar. Mm-hmm. And my head was like that. But yeah, yeah. Willie Limond, I lost my title to Willie Limond. Yeah.
How was that feeling?
I was done once I won the British title.
So you completed that, you took the foot off the gas again?
No disrespect to Willie, because, you know, he was a good fighter. And you know what I found in boxing? Because I didn't start till 26, what you can't give people is experience, can you? So the ones that had been doing it a long time, I was always a little step behind them. They just knew too much, you know? Like, I'm sure you doing these now, you know miles more than what you knew when you first did them. Yeah. So I'm getting in there with Willie Limond, and he knows every trick in the book. He's been in with Morales, Khan. He's boxed since he was like 10 years of age. So he was just always that little fraction ahead of me. You know what I mean? And I like Willie. I know, you know, you don't want to lose your British title ever, but I didn't mind losing it.
Yeah,
losing
he's a good guy. Very funny bastard. Yeah. On Twitter, like, you're no holds barred. You don't hold back in people, but you've got the love-hate relationship with the Celtic fans. Why is that? Why is it you constantly got the spoon out?
Well, because I support Rangers. and they don't like it.
Because I always see, oh, here it goes again. With Rangers wins up, and then it's just, you've got the spoon out, you're mixing it, and everybody bites. Like, Glasgow, no matter Celtic Rangers, if you're against one, they fucking bite. And it's not just one, you'll get them all attacking.
Well, you know what? I remember when I went up and we signed with Rangers, they actually sat me down and said, they spoke to me about obviously the religion, this, that, and the other. Said, there's certain things you cannot do up here, you cannot say. Said, if anyone asks you what religion you are, they said, just say I'm the same as you. Just say whatever they are, fucking you are. I said, don't go down that route. And at that point, I didn't really understand the Protestant and the Catholic and the hatred that they've got for each other.
Still bad.
I've got loads of fans that are Celtic fans, so I have a good laugh with them. And like I said, I support Rangers because when I went up there, it blew my mind. And the people treated me like I was like the second coming of Jesus Christ. And the whole city, I just like fell in love with the place instantly. And I'd love to go back there in some capacity, in a football capacity. The whole city, the whole football, it just blew my mind. It was something else. It's like, I don't know, when you first see something like that, it was wow. And yeah, and ever since then, I've followed them. Not religiously, but yeah, they're my team.
Yeah.
And the Celtic fans don't like me for it. It is what it is, isn't it? You can't please everyone.
You've obviously tried managers. You've been a manager as well. Is it Gainsborough's your last?
Yeah, Gainsborough was my last club.
Because I interviewed Rico Franco yesterday, spoke highly of you.
Yeah.
He's from that neck of the woods.
He is.
I'm fucking... got up, cut us on the podcast the next day. Rico's a undefeated bare knuckle fighter. Great story, great guy.
Yeah.
And he was speaking about you being the manager there. I said, I'm fucking interviewing him tomorrow.
Well, I said to our chairman, we should fight, me and Rico, get it on at Gainsborough. You know, we should fight against each other. And then when I went to go and see the chairman one day, Rico was in there because the chairman was sponsoring him. And when I stood next to him, I was like, nah, fuck that. He's massive. He's big lump, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a big boy.
Yeah, I didn't fancy that one. Tough guy.
Machine.
Yeah.
What's the hardest thing to do? Manager, football, boxing? Is that tough? Yeah. What's it like before a fight, after a fight, compared to football before and after?
Boxing mentally is difficult because you're bearing your soul to people to watch. You're fighting. That's a personal thing, fighting, because I'm an alpha male. So when I lose a fight, I feel like I've been stripped of a bit of my manhood. So the pressure leading into that, having to make the weight, everything that goes with it, emotionally, it's draining. So after a fight, you'd think you won out, celebrate. I never used to go out after fights, ever. I used to fight Saturday night. I used to get a shower and be emotionally, even if I won in one round, two rounds, three rounds, I wasn't physically tired, just emotionally drained and relieved. I think as well, because I knew I was never that good. And I won the British title, but I got there by bloody-mindedness. I never outboxed anyone in my life. I never have. Honestly, I haven't. My fights I won by just being tough and getting through it. And I had a few skills, obviously, to get to the level I got to. But every fight was difficult because I didn't have that skill set of a Willie Limond, you know, a Ricky Burns, or the good ones that have been doing it for a long time. Mm-hmm. So boxing will always be no matter what I do, my biggest achievement. Obviously, there's some other great things that happen with the football, and but like I say, because boxing is so hard, and that's what makes it so great, isn't it?
Yeah. Going forward for the future, Curtis, what's your plans, brother?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing Her Majesty the Queen going down to
that's
see...
That's right, you got it. Was it BEM?
Yeah, BEM, yeah.
Congratulations.
British, thank you. So a British Embassy medal. So
you got that at Christmas?
I got that at Christmas, yeah. Mm. I thought that was a blag as well. Uh-huh. When I got an email from Her Majesty the Queen. I'm thinking, fucking hell, I'm going to jail here. What's happened? And then when I read it, I got a number to ring, so I rang up and the lady answered the phone and was like, oh, I've got an email. She said, what's your name? I said, Curtis Woodhouse. And she went like quiet on the phone for about 15 seconds. So I'm thinking, she must be going down the list or something. She's like, how are you spelling Woodhouse? I'm like, oh yeah, you're here. Congratulations, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. So that was amazing. That's an amazing feeling to be recognised for your hard work, really.
Football and boxing.
Yeah, my football careers, people had miles better careers, the same with boxing. But I think the crossover is something that will be never done again. So yeah, I'm looking forward to going down and meeting the Royals, I suppose.
So you should hold your head high for the transition that you've done to still kicking on in life, even your dark days where you felt, I can't go on anymore. Mm. You've still pushed on. So people can take inspiration from that. Take away all the bullshit from Twitter and social media, from what you've actually achieved and actually what you've went through. So I take my hat off to you, brother, because it's not easy. Yeah. I speak to people who battle. Some people don't go through it.
Yeah.
People it's not going to say easy, but people are taking their life too frequently for my liking, and it's only getting worse. So it takes a big bit of courage to push through those dark times. Now, no matter if you win the British title, no matter if you go and fucking manage Liverpool, you'll still battle because we're human beings. It's normal. It is our emotions, but it's not normal to live there every day to have those battles and have that mindset of, I don't live there anymore. I still battle, but the pain is not there waking up every day and think, I wake up because I've got a bit of a purpose and I've got a bit of a passion now, which is key as well, and I'm exercising more frequently and that helps, but I still have my moments and I think, fuck all this shit, I'm kidding myself on here, and I still have that self-doubt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's difficult, but I know you're working with kids to now try and help them.
Yeah, the realisation for me is how much I've got to give back.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you've loved that,
yeah. And giving back's a brilliant thing, mm-hmm. You know. I set up the It Starts Monday thing that we do now, and it's basically for men that are, you know, looking to get in shape. What we say is we're looking for a healthy mind, body, and soul, because everything's linked. You know, when you're training, you're feeling good, you're eating right, you feel better, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, and we've got loads of people on there that have struggled in the past, and we're just giving them a bit of a community where we can talk and have accountability as well, you know. So you've got to check in, you've got to eat good, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And it's beautiful, and it's stretched all around the country. We've got 200 members up in Scotland. It's brilliant. We've got somebody over in Barbados, got a few in Ireland. It's crazy, and all it is a group of like-minded men that have maybe lost their way a little bit and need that community feel. And it's amazing. It's probably the best thing I've ever been involved in, because it's so positive. Every day you go on and you see and read other people's stories. And like you said, there's too many men taking their lives, isn't there, at such an early age.
Yeah.
There's got to be a reason for it. And hopefully if we can help in that. And kids as well, you know. We're doing a charity walk. You'll have to jump on with us.
I will, man.
We're doing a 10K walk up in Edinburgh on June the 12th.
Send me all the details. We'll post it on social media.
That'll be amazing.
I'll be there.
And we're doing it for Sam H Charity, which is a mental health charity up in Scotland that work closely with children as well. Because again, you know, we understand the tools to deal with it because we're adults. Kids, imagine dealing with it as a kid and you don't really know what's going on. You don't know how to deal with these emotions, you know. And Sam H do loads of amazing work up in Scotland. So yeah, we're finishing. Is it the Military Mile that it's called?
Yeah,
which leads into Edinburgh
hole.
Castle.
Yeah.
So we're doing a 10K walk and then we're finishing.
Yeah, let us know, man. I'll be there, brother.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Your book, Box to Box, how was it writing that? Was that 2016?
Yeah, so that was difficult.
A lot of emotion in that.
Yeah, a lot of emotion in that. And that was probably the first time I'd ever spoke about my childhood. So that was tough, but it was good to get it out. I've actually never read it, which is quite...
You tend to see that. A lot of people who write books don't read their books. Like, I don't... Only time I watch these podcasts is to try and get a trailer, but I fucking don't like watching them.
Yeah. Well, I've seen the book in email form.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of sign off on it first. But I've never read the book. My kids have got it. I don't think my kids have read it either. Yeah, they're my only three sales, I think. But I've had like loads of people have contacted me and said, we've read your book. It's like, it was amazing. It's very honest. And because I'm in a position, what I'm in regarding myself is I can be honest. It doesn't affect me either way. I can be out there and speak about what I've been through and speak about my past because I'm comfortable within my own skin. Mm-hmm. And like I say, it's taken me a long time to get there, but
yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah, fair play to you though. Who's the best player you've ever played with?
With? Oof.
Or against?
Against Steven Gerrard.
Yeah.
Easy. Yeah. Everyone asks me all the time. The guy's like, as if you think you...
Doesn't break sweat, they can't.
Mate, he fucking didn't against me. What a player. He's like, if you could build the perfect player, it's him. I didn't realise how big he was. Have you ever seen him like in
yeah, part? About 6'1", 6'2", yeah.
Yeah, strong, powerful. He'd kick you, score a goal. He just had everything. Mm-hmm. You know what I remember about him as well? He smelt lovely. He did. He smelt lovely. Uh-huh. The aftershave he had on. But he smelt lovely. Proper player. Great player. And obviously, he's not a bad manager either.
Yeah, he's done well, man.
Been amazing.
For looking back in your life, just for your, what do you think of it so far? You're still young, but you're still only 41. But what do you get telling your story just now? How do you feel?
For a long time, a long, long time, would just be one big disappointment, how I looked at everything. But now, amazing. My life's been amazing. Yeah. I'm so blessed to have had so many amazing things and so many dark things to come through and to leave me in the position where I am now. As a 41-year-old, I feel like I've got it. I've got control of this amazing thing we call life. So yeah, I look back with amazing pride at what I've done. I quite often drive around where I'm from, where I was brought up, and the journey I've been on from there to where I've been all around the world doing what I'm doing fills me with immense pride. So it took a long time to get to where I am, but I look back at my life so far and I'm like, wow.
Yeah,
you're killing it, big lad.
Yeah, good on keep you, going. Brother. Because yeah. If you never went through all the dark times in your life, you wouldn't be able to help the people you are now.
Yeah.
And that's the key to life. And I always say this shit, but the gift in life is given.
Yeah,
no matter 100%. What it is, you're helping other people, you also help yourself.
Yeah,
and I wish I could help everybody on the fucking planet. I wish I could reply to every message now, but I can't. But I do reply to most that I can when I've got the time. But just giving that people that bit of inspiration. But you've got to lead by the front and lead by example. Now, you've lived through the dark times. You've also lived through the glory times as well. You've had a lot of success. £1 million signing on fees, British titles, fighting against all the odds, pushing through the racism, pushing through the hostile environment in your household, and still here to tell the tale. Now, that tells you how much a character you are. Yeah. But fuck everybody else.
Yeah.
We're still going to battle. We've got that character. Listen, we can go and stay with monks for 5 years and come back and go on social media and still reply to people and call them wankers and cunts. It's just ingrained into us not to quit.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of life. But Curtis, for anybody that's watching, maybe going through the struggle, brother, maybe it's battling with depression or not feeling good enough, what advice would you give for them?
I think the advice that really hit home with me is to talk, you know, to really talk and don't be ashamed of what situations you are in. And I know we're talking, we haven't dealt with therapy, but I'd definitely say reach out to professional people that can help, that have got experience in that field, because that's what they're there for. And the worst thing you can do is bottle everything up, because a small problem becomes a big problem. And then, like you said, there's so many people that feel there's no way out. And there always is, isn't there? There's always another way apart from taking your own life.
Yeah.
And that is obviously the mess it leaves behind as well is devastating for so many families out there. But I'd say talk, and things are never as bad as how you feel, are they? Mm-hmm. Things are never quite as bad as what you feel, and tomorrow's always a new day. But reach out 100% and talk to people, especially men. And obviously women suffer as well, but men, it breaks my heart when I put social media on and see like the footballer the other week, you know, that taken his own life. It's really sad, isn't it? It's heartbreaking, really. So we need to, as men, we need to look out for each other. We need to drop the ego a little bit and not be scared to reach out.
Yeah, but the beauty of life, people can change and make choices, and you are in control of your life. If you are feeling depressed or in a dark place, if you are under eating, overeating, not fit enough, battling with addictions, in prison just now, you can make changes in your life.
One person that when I was having a really, really bad time that I reached out to was Leon McKenzie. I just sent him a message on Twitter. I was going through like a really, really tough, probably one of the darkest points that I've been. And I'd not spoke to Leon for ages. And I know he does quite a lot with mental health. And I sent him a direct message on Twitter just saying, have you got a number I can contact you on, mate? And I just reached out to him and said, listen, I'm in a bad way here, mate. Could you help me in any way? So he sent me over loads of contacts to speak to. The PFA were fantastic. Gave me 12, I think it's 12 free sessions with somebody. And that was a big help. And luckily, for some reason, I don't know why I reached out to Leon. I think I might have seen something on Twitter. This was a good few years back now. But luckily, he was there. And I knew that if I did, he would be able to help. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, even when people aren't contacting you and they're doing good things, sometimes just drop them a message because there is that help out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes everyone's like, you know, saying, you know, to reach out. Sometimes you've got to reach in as well. You understand? Sometimes you've got to reach in and ask people, you know, are you okay? And Leon McKenzie was brilliant for me. And I played football with Leon, but outside of that, we're not like buddies. He's a friend, but we haven't had like a deep relationship. We just played football together, really. Mm-hmm. But Leon was great for me and put me on the right path to dealing with a lot of issues.
Yeah,
took me a while, but I'm
here. Yeah, no, get a smile on your face, brother. That's the main thing. But it just shows you that one message to even a complete stranger to reach out can change your whole outcome in life, because it's just about getting help, no matter how successful you are, no matter how much money you've got, no matter if you stop drinking, stop taking, whatever the fuck it is, you can make changes and still battle.
Yeah.
It's just called life. It's just pushing through it. Keep swimming against the tide and never fucking sink.
Never sink.
Keep going. But Curtis, listen, brother, for coming on today and telling your story, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think you've had a phenomenal career.
Thank you.
I look forward to what you see.
And I've retired now. Podcast done. I've got out.
Unless you come on for a part two, brother.
I've got out at the top.
Listen, top fascinating man. Guy, mate. And listen, God bless you for the future.
Cheers, buddy.
You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.